It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
We assume a call to play ball is soon at hand. And then again, we've assumed a lot of things these last few months, and how's that gone for us? Trying to stay positive, assuming we all wear our masks and maintain social distance, and there's no alien attack or a runaway zombie horde. Mark your calendar, play ball will be heard from an umpire's mouth, muffled though it may be from behind a face guard, on the night of Friday, July 24th, against the Sad Sack Baltimore Orioles. The first of not 162 games, but hopefully as many as 60. Josh Lewin with you for episode 262 of Red Sox Beat, presented by CLNS Media. 262, what do we got for 262? I got the career batting average of Rusney Castillo. All that and seven career home runs for $72.5 million. 2.62 was Roger Clemens' ERA in 1991, the year he was in a rotation with Mike Gardner, Tom Bolton, Matt Young, Kevin Morton, Danny Darwin, Greg Harris, and Joe Hesketh. Hesketh was 12-4, Clemens 18-10. Every other starter I just named had a losing record or was at 500 that year at best. Anybody remember Dan Petrie was a Red Sox? He was that year. The Carlos Quintana, Mike Brumley, Bob Zupsik years. Scott Cooper, Kevin Romine, Wayne Housey. All right, I'll stop. Anyway, the Sox barely over 500 that year, 84 wins. 84 wins this year is not possible. 60 is the max. If you win 33, you're probably in the playoffs. We will talk about all of that in a bit with the great Sean McAdam. He is our featured writer on this episode. We're also going to get back into our satchel of spring training interviews. And who knew these would end up being popular? I just tried to talk to as many random Red Sox as I could way back in late February, figuring now we'll sprinkle these interviews in here, there, and everywhere during the season. Since there is no real season, let's start grinding through these interviews. We're going to have Colton Brewer. That's as random as I can get, but a guy that I think is just a terrific spirit and wears the uniform so proudly. I think you're going to like hearing from Colton Brewer. We'll do that in a little bit as well. And hey, you know, there is no shortage of action going on right now with Bet Online Sports. They are making their way back with the UFC and NASCAR and soccer leading the way, of course. But Bet Online has all the best odds and lines for the upcoming matches this weekend, for example. Bet Online has simulated stuff for you as well. Casino games, poker tournaments, all the best props in the business. You got to go. You got to visit betonline.ag or use your mobile device and join as soon as you can. You'll get the special welcome bonuses from us, too, if you go and hook it up that way. That's BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Always proud to have them part of everything that they're with here on CLNS, including Red Sox Beat. One thing I want to get to, because nobody seems to be talking about this, again, assuming we have a season, there's going to be a lot of expectation on Alex Verdugo in there with Mookie now playing ball in L.A. David Price is not, by the way. We'll talk more about that in a bit, too. Alex Verdugo will wear number 99. No Red Sox player has ever worn higher than 94, if you remember Dalyer Hinojosa for one game in 2015. But a quick Verdugo story for you. Take you all the way back, actually, to 1989. Not too far away from when we were just talking about Bob Zupsik. But a very adrift Las Vegas teenager by the name of Andre Agassi found a guy named Gil Reyes, who was then the strength coach for UNLV's basketball team. When the Runnin' Rebels won the national title in 1990, Reyes quit so he could just full-time tutor Andre Agassi, and he built him up mentally and physically. I think mentally more than anything else. But Agassi, of course, became a sporting icon, would go on to describe Reyes as his surrogate father. Well, fast forward a few years, Reyes had himself a new mentee, another young, athletically gifted guy, kind of a prodigy, but a little bit out there. And Alex Verdugo was that guy. Met with Reyes 5 years ago, That was through a cousin who served as general counsel for Agassi and his wife at the time, Steffi Graf. And there was Verdugo with Gil Reyes, 2015, 2016, and a lot of hard work, both physically and mentally there, kind of a behavioral transformation, because we don't need another Manny Ramirez, a guy who wore 99 in L.A. Manny, by the way, will be one of the highest paid Red Sox players this year. Just got $2 million last week. That's the latest deferred payment from the contract he agreed to before the 2001 season. He's getting those payments through 2026. Not quite Bobby Bonilla stuff, but there it is. Dustin Pedroia is scheduled to receive $18 million in deferments from 2021 through 2028. Chris Sale is going to have $50 million coming his way from 2035 through 39 if you're scoring at home. It's like those future college football schedules. You see, I mean, I'm looking at UCLA. They play like at Wisconsin in 2028, but somehow somebody's already done that work. All right, let's do some work now ourselves. We will get to Colton Brewer in a bit. I want to get to Sean McAdam first. Let's wind it up here and talk to the man from the Boston Sports Journal. So, Sean, thank you so much for joining. I know these are beyond crazy times. Walk me through, since you're there and I'm not, just the actual, when you're at Fenway, what's it like?
Well, it is it is a different experience, Josh, certainly. This is my 32nd year covering Major League Baseball, and I never thought I would need to answer a health questionnaire or have my temperature taken, or for that matter, conduct all interviews via Zoom over the course of the morning and afternoon. And yet, thanks to the pandemic, that's exactly where we are. We were talking today in the press box about the fact that it is possible that we will go the entire season while not ever coming face-to-face with the manager or many of the players that we're speaking to on a daily basis. All done in the interest of health and safety, so we understand, but it certainly is unusual and unprecedented in every regard.
What does Fenway itself look like? I mean, do you guys have any peek into the suites where the guys are pairing up to do this Noah's Ark dressing room thing? Do you get to see the batting cages in the hallways? What's it all actually looking like?
We are kind of sequestered in the press box and under orders not to roam around the ballpark. We are not allowed down in the seats or the lower bowl. We are not allowed on the concourse. Obviously, we are not allowed in the clubhouse, but for that matter, a lot of the players aren't either. As you referenced, many of the players, in fact, all of the players, I believe, are using the luxury suites at Fenway as an ad hoc dressing room. So when they report in the morning, they go through much the same intake that we do. In fact, theirs is more rigorous, of course, because they're actually being tested for COVID-19 on a daily basis. We are not. So once they go through that, they go upstairs and are assigned, along with one teammate, one of the suites where they get dressed and prepare and then come down through the stands and onto the field to take part in whatever drill or wherever they've been assigned, whether it's batting practice or infield drills or whatever they're doing. Some are also being put on a shuttle bus in the morning and sent out to Chestnut Hill, about maybe 7 or 8 miles away, maybe not even quite that many. The home of Boston College, which is sort of the adjunct training facility. That's one of the drawbacks of Fenway, and for that matter, every other major league ballpark, is that there's only one field and one diamond and one mound and a couple of bullpens. So in order to get work for what is now 49 players in camp, the Red Sox are sending some of their overflow guys and a lot of their pitchers out to BC's baseball complex, and we don't see them at all and aren't allowed out there. So it's a rather restricted view. We see what is going on. I'll put it to you this way. You know, you've been in that press box many times and in that broadcast booth. You see what you see is on the field and nothing else, because you don't have access to any place else in the ballpark.
You know, it strikes me, Sean, I don't know the last time you've seen the movie Castaway with Tom Hanks, the one where he ends up talking to a volleyball. And frankly, I think we're all this close to talking to volleyballs right now is where we all are anyway. But before the plane crashes, his biggest problem is he's got like a toothache, and he's in there like studying his tooth in the bathroom mirror of the plane, like it's the biggest problem that he's ever going to face. Then all of a sudden, everybody's dead except for him, and he's a castaway. So, it feels like some of that with baseball is kind of true too, where, you know, why are they not playing this game in the afternoon? You know, why is this one, you know, on a getaway day? Why are they playing at 7:10 p.m.? And how come they closed the press box dining room in the seventh inning? And it's almost embarrassing that that's the kind of stuff that we used to worry about.
Yeah, it has certainly put things in perspective. I will say that, you know, there's kind of a gallows humor about it. I think you also know, Josh, that there are few professions or industries where people complain more than the sports media about the things that inconvenience us and travel and, oh, this game's going into extra innings, I'm going to miss my flight, all those things. You know, the last few months has put that into perspective, hopefully, for many of us. It is not typical or normal what we're going through, but then that's to be expected because these are hardly typical or normal times.
You got a peek at the schedule as we're recording this on a Monday evening, and 7 of the first 22 games of the year at Yankee Stadium. Terrific. Yankees, by the way, closed with 20 of 23 games against teams that lost at least 95 times last year. And, you know, everything's new. Everything's going to be weird. I get it. It's an Orioles opener. The Orioles haven't opened a season at Fenway since 1966 when Frank Robinson was brought in from Cincinnati. I mean, that's a long time ago. But when you looked at the schedule, were you excited, Sean, just to see a schedule?
But you're telling me that the Orioles are going to have someone who wins the Triple Crown this year, Josh? Is that your way of explaining this?
Because that's why
Frank Robinson was a Triple Crown winner in 1966, to be followed a year later by Yaz, of course, and only one in the American League since then, Miguel Cabrera. I digress. It's the schedule is like the rest of it, strange. You know, the Orioles are an AL East opponent, so I hadn't realized it was that long since they had open the season. You would have thought that there would have been something since then. I know the Red Sox, in my time on the beat, have opened in Baltimore a few times. I suppose it's an easy way for the Red Sox to ease into this schedule, strange as it is, to play the team that may well be, along with Detroit and Kansas City, one of the three worst in the American League. So that helps a little bit. And then on the back end, I noticed that six of the last 12 for the Red Sox involve either the Marlins or Orioles, although the other six are the Yankees and Braves. So, you know, look, we could sit here and analyze the schedule forever and come up with little peculiarities or tough stretches or easier periods on the schedule. But in a 60-game schedule, where you're crossing over and playing 30-year games in the other league, it's all pretty strange right now.
And, you know, we knew, I think, Sean, that at some point, look, I mean, even though it was great news to see that only 1.2% of the major league population had tested positive initially for COVID-19, we figured there would be a Red Sox component to that. Josh Taylor and Darwinson Hernandez were the guys. And thankfully, it doesn't seem like it's as serious as, for example, Freddie Freeman is dealing with in Atlanta. But were you surprised it was only, at least so far, knock wood, Josh Taylor and Darwinson Hernandez?
Yeah, that's a remarkably low percentage for the 48 or 49 players in the Red Sox pool right now. They, of course, at some point will add up to 11 more players before opening day. And there's further no guarantee that there won't be more cases pop up. In fact, I'd say it's quite likely, given the exposure to either Josh Taylor as part of the intake. Now, Darwinson Hernandez is still in, or recently was in Venezuela and has not made his way here, so he hasn't come in contact with anybody on the roster or the organization. We've also got the uncertainty that's around Eduardo Rodriguez, who remains home in South Florida, having been exposed to someone who tested positive. And finally, we've got Bobby Dahl back, who they are not confirming as a positive test, but is unaccounted for. And they're, you know, they've said there are some intake issues. So whether he got a false positive or is taking the test again, still, your point is well taken, Josh. It's a relatively small number of infections for 50 or so people. The trick will be keeping it that low. And you know, on the topic of tests and some people and teams having to cancel workouts both today, Monday, as we speak, and then this past Sunday on the holiday weekend, you've got teams that can't get the testers at the ballpark, can't get their results. They're unhappy with putting players and staff members at risk. To a man, the Red Sox people and players we've talked to have gone out of their way to salute the Red Sox for doing a good job with the protocol, with the idea of using the suites as adjunct changing areas and clubhouse areas and making sure that everyone understands the rules and having masks available and having sanitizer available. I was struck today as we asked about this, gee, all this chaos in some of the other camps, what's your experience been like? And the players were uniformly supportive of how things have been set up at Fenway. So the hope is that it stays that way, but of course, no guarantees.
So I'm peeking across the other coast here, Sean, and it looks like Mookie Betts will actually swing a bat in Dodger blue. David Price has opted out. Now, that'll save the Red Sox about $6 million in real money, and that's great, I guess. Were you surprised about that? Because David obviously has his own way of doing things. We should note that he also paid minor leaguers out of his own pocket. I mean, so he's giving money away and not making much this year. I know he's already made a bazillion dollars. I get that. But what's your take on David sitting it out?
Well, I think you sort of hinted at it earlier, Josh. I mean, David sort of marches to his own beat and own drum, and he's always been that way. So I think I've lost the capacity to be surprised by anything he says or does. He tends to not subject himself to groupthink and makes his own decisions, and this is another example of that. You know, I wrote over the weekend that I wondered whether Price's decision to opt out might not cause some sort of domino effect because, as you know, being around the game as much as you are, Josh, Price is looked upon by a lot of younger players and pitchers in particular as a role model and as a leader. And I wonder if his decision, and everyone has to make their own call, and as you point out, Price has made some $200 million in his career and has got another $64 million coming to him on his deal after this year. So he is uniquely positioned to make this from a financial standpoint, but I wonder what sort of impact it has on others, because although fans in Boston may not remember him fondly, his teammates always salute him for being a guy who looks out for them, and that issue about paying the Dodgers minor leaguers is further evidence of that. I wonder if he might be kind of a Pied Piper in that regard, where some guys say, well, he's doing it, maybe I should reassess my own situation.
You know, lost in all the discussion of the really important stuff out there, Sean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, you know, somebody's got to get the ball on opening day. We know it's not Sale. We know it's not Price. Is it Eovaldi, who was tickling 100 miles an hour last time we all saw what spring training in Fort Myers looked like? And what's it going to look like beyond that? I mean, the Reds, for example, are looking at a four-man rotation where starters piggyback off each other. Gabe Kapler in San Francisco says he doesn't expect the starters to throw more than three innings the first time through the rotation. Tampa Bay, the Rays, Charlie Morton's expecting to throw four innings and that's it when the season starts. It doesn't look like the Red Sox are really doing all that, right? I mean, if Evaldi can ramp up to go 5 or 6 on opening day, would he do that?
Yeah, I've been struck by that too, Josh, that both Ron Renicke, the manager, and Dave Bush, the pitching coach, have taken kind of traditional, no, we're thinking these guys are going to be good for 5 or 6 and 80 or 90 right out of the chute. So, you know, for an organization that is definitely analytically inclined and has a general manager who certainly has been unafraid to experiment and be a little unorthodox. He, of course, was with the Rays when they instituted the opener concept. So it's not as if Chaim Bloom or anybody else here is afraid to do something a little different. But right now they're looking at kind of a four-man rotation with the fifth spot going to a closer role, to an opener role, rather. So given Rodriguez's delays in getting here, that may have already taken him out of the opening day assignment, and I wouldn't be surprised if Evaldi gets the ball on July 24th. But I think you're looking at a front four in some form or fashion of being Evaldi, Rodriguez, Martin Perez, Ryan Weber is the number four. And then, as I said, right now they seem to be leaning toward the opener for the number five spot with any number of candidates in there. But they are not, in fact, Dave Bush flatly said he was not thinking right now about a four-man rotation as some teams are. They're going the more traditional route, albeit with the opener in the number five slot.
Couple more for you, Sean, here on Red Sox Beat before I let you roll back to what you got to be doing here. Ron Renicke, what a weird introduction, I guess, to the Boston populace. I mean, it's a guy who's got a big league winning record as a manager, by the way. He's 11 games over 500 or 12 games over, something like that. Nobody ever thought he'd be a manager again, but here he is. How, and I know you knew Ron a little bit because he's been on the staff, but how do you think he's doing handling all this?
I actually think he's a, you know, I was a little surprised the Red Sox went with him back in February when they made him first interim manager and then later took the tag off, because I thought Chaim Bloom, being from outside the organization, wasn't tied to anybody here. He didn't have a history with Renicke, and he would want to put his stamp on this team by choosing his own manager. That was made more difficult, of course, by the timing of all of this, where it happens late in the offseason, where teams would not have necessarily have allowed a member of their coaching staff to leave at that late hour, leaving them in the lurch. But the more I watch Renicke, the more I'm convinced that, particularly under these circumstances, he may be a very good choice here. And for this reason, Josh, this is a veteran guy. He's 63 years old. He's been in the game forever. He's filled virtually every role you could think of. He's been a minor league player, a major league player. He's been a minor league manager, a major league manager, and a bench coach and a major league coach. He's done it all. And in that sense, I don't think anything rattles him. You know, if you had a first-year manager or a first-time manager or a younger guy with all of this to deal with, the coronavirus, the late start, the 3-month shutdown, the 60-game sprint, that would be a lot for, and it is a lot for anyone. And in fact, Renicke said recently that this is the busiest and craziest time he can remember that he's had in baseball. But I think he's got sort of this fatherly presence to him where he doesn't get rattled. And I think setting that sort of tone and message to the players is an important one at this time.
Last one for you, buddy, before you get going here, and it's kind of a two-parter. I've already talked about Alex Verdugo a little bit. He's a newcomer that's going to be leaned on and looked at. The other one to me is Colin McHugh, who obviously, if he's healthy, that's a big add. Verdugo and McHugh in that order, what's your take so far?
Yeah, the good news on Verdugo, on both of them, they're the two probably most significant new pieces to this roster, and neither would have been ready to play on March 26th had the season begun when it should have. But in the interim, they've had some time to rehab and get healthy. Verdugo is a complete 100% go. He said so the other day. He's able to take full cuts. He's checked his swing a few times. For those who don't know, he was dealing with a stress fracture in the lower back and needed recovery time, but he's been cleared, so that's good. McHugh is not yet 100% go, but he's getting there. He did throw a bullpen on Friday. He is, miles ahead of where he would have been at the end of March, where he hadn't even been off a mound yet. And, you know, I talked about the possibility of the opener in the five spot, but if McHugh can make some strides here in the next couple of weeks, he's an intriguing candidate for that fifth spot, or at least being part of the opener equation, maybe being the bulk guy where he gives you three or four innings after the opener is out after an inning or two. So, they liked his versatility, Josh. He's someone that's pitched in relief and pitched well, and also won in double figures as a starter only a few years ago for the Astros. So, in that regard, like a lot of other teams, the Yankees got healthier with Judge and Paxton and some guys that would have been delayed. That's the case with the Red Sox here with both Verdugo and McHugh. As I said, Verdugo 100% go, McHugh getting very close to it.
Fingers crossed on so much of this. And, Sean, we could go for three more hours about all the different permutations and discussions to have. But this is a podcast. It's supposed to be 30 minutes. We're going to try to keep it at that here. Thank you for everything. Stay safe, stay healthy in this weird new world that we're in. And hopefully, God willing, my friend, we'll see you soon up close.
I hope to do that, Josh. Thanks for having me. Always good to talk baseball with you.
All right, back to different sounding audio now because we're off of Zoom. Many, many thanks once again to Sean McAdam. And now we'll get you to that promised Colton Brewer interview from, my gosh, how long ago was this now? Late February? I can't even do the math. But as we do our little get to know you segment, and I think this is important that you get to know as many Red Sox as possible as part of why we're here. Colton Brewer, the big right-hander out of Canton, Texas. He's 6'4", 230. Got into 58 games last year. It'd be astonishing if he did that this year. 4.24 ERA, but a 1.7 whip, which he knows has got to come down. So let's wrap things up here talking to our good friend Colton Brewer, winding it all the way back to spring training. About the Colton Brewer experience. Always start out by asking, when did you know it was going to be baseball and not something else?
I think I was like really young, probably like in elementary school, where I was just kind of above everybody else's talent and playing kids older than me and stuff. And I never in my mind thought, back then I thought I wouldn't play baseball. There wasn't anything in the back of my mind that didn't have baseball in the picture. And so I just kept rolling with it and kept trying, and I ended up in the big leagues.
So you must have had a support system that was helpful. You didn't have teachers try to talk you out of it, a parent try to talk you out of it?
I mean, my parents were always very supportive, and I remember going to, like, some meetings and stuff in school, and they were like, what are your plans for later? I said, baseball player. Every time. I was like, what about college? I was like, I'll play baseball in college.
Right.
And he said, what about after that? And I said, I'm going to still be in baseball, whether it's being anything I can do for the game. That's what I wanted to do, is just do baseball. And
you're a persistent little kid, it sounds like. I mean, you weren't going to just not your dream.
I mean, I was just really good back then, and everybody noticed that I was good too, and they're like, man, you're gonna be good one day. I'm like,
no way.
Well, I mean, I felt like if I could do it back then, I could do it when I was a little older, just if I keep, you know, that same mindset of just having fun and realizing that the game is a game.
Right.
And I think it's awesome when somebody goes through that kind of thing. Like, if you talk to most people, they're gonna say, you know, I had teachers say, no, try something else.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, I feel like everybody has a similar story, and it was like they just didn't give up and they just wanted it.
Is part of it, do you think, where you grew up? I mean, if you had grown up in a place where sports wasn't a big deal, or especially baseball wasn't a big deal, you ever think maybe it would have been different? Because in East Texas, I think people understand, right, innately, that, you know, they sports is a way to something.
They do. I think if I grew up in a little bit of a different environment, maybe where it was really cold during the winters and stuff like that, maybe it would have changed my mind. Or like, and my dad didn't even grow up a huge baseball fan. He was a track star and he was a football player.
Really?
And
wow.
He didn't even play much baseball, but it's just something that I always knew how to do. And even when I was in diapers, my dad was throwing me baseballs and I was hitting it around the house like I was Mark McGuire or something like that. But I mean, I just stuck with it.
You mentioned football, and because, again, where you grew up, I mean, as much as baseball is huge, football is always going to be huger. So you mentioned your dad has that background. Did you try it and just not like it, or what was that?
I love football. I never got really the opportunity to start in front of some other players. I was kind of a late bloomer. And in baseball, you don't really have late bloomers. It's either you can hit the ball or you can't. You know, it's not stronger, weaker, you know, like it is in football. I was a late bloomer. I was slow. I didn't play for a team that was exceptionally very good, and I wasn't playing either. So I was just like, you know, what's the point of getting hurt and ruining baseball? And I actually quit my junior year, and it was just strictly baseball from then on. And then I hit a growth spurt, and they're like, can you come play for us? I'm like, I've already sold into baseball, and like, this is it. So,
are there players that people would know, even if they're not from that area, Dallas, East Texas, that played football, that were in your region, in your county, where it's like, oh, that's, I'd know that name?
Yeah, for sure. We've actually had, you know, I wasn't growing up, but we actually had a guy named Adrian Peterson who grew up down the road from where you did, and everybody was like, if you could be like AP, you can be anything you want. I mean, and we also had some guys in our district that did some D1 things, and a couple guys went to Texas, and one guy actually played behind DeMarco Murray at Oklahoma, and so he never really got his shot, I guess, because he had to play behind, I think it was Murray and Peterson at the time.
Did you go and watch those guys play? Did you know they were going to be that good?
Never got to really watch them play, but when they came over and played us when I was like junior high coming into high school, I was like, I remember who those guys were.
Are you a Cowboys fan?
I'm a Cowboys fan.
Yeah, I mean, that's never going to change.
No, it's never going to change, no.
What about other interests? I mean, do you follow the Mavericks? Do you follow the Stars?
I actually, you know, any sport that was that I was decent at, I loved playing it and wanted to get better at it. And I actually loved the game of basketball. I actually loved playing it. I hustled my ass off.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
yeah.
And I would score baskets too, but, you know, growing up in that small town there, we didn't have access to, you know, basketball lessons or anything like that.
It was a DIY project, right? I mean, you got to teach yourself.
Yeah, it was.
So were you like Mr. Floorburn? I mean, you just like get out there, dive around and make plays?
I mean, I just consider myself a player that can, anything you put me in the mix of, I can go do it.
Yeah.
I may not be the best at it, but like I can play with anybody, you know. I'm not going to slow the game down at all.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm a student to any type of game, and I just love sports.
And you grew up, I mean, I know you weren't like right in Dallas, but I'm just thinking about from Dirk Nowitzki to, you know, all the guys with the Rangers, the Pudge Rodriguez's and Juan Gonzalez's, all these people that were just these celestial comets of talent that you could watch.
And honestly, I couldn't have grown up a better time. And I was actually a huge Rangers fan too. I mean, you had guys like A-Rod. You had Nelson Cruz on the team, Farzan Soriano. When I was
right.
growing
we had
up.
Palmeiro. You had all
you
these
had
guys.
All, yeah. You had all these guys. I mean, I remember going to my first Rangers game and I saw them. I'm like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Like, there they are in the flesh, right?
And I'm sitting there thinking, like, watching in this game, I'm probably like 10 years old, being like, I can play shortstop right now. I could take A-Rod's spot.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, I always felt myself in that atmosphere.
Yeah.
I would not be happy if I quit when I was younger. You know, I would, it's just something that was always on my mind. It's just that I could see myself playing in the big leagues.
Well, it's funny because, you know, LeVar Ball got all that crap, and rightly so, for a lot of his stuff. But, his, you know, the one thing that always stuck with me that I think is exactly right is speak it into existence, right? And you kind of, I mean, you did
you
that.
Believe it, it, if you believe something will happen, I mean, the chances are going to grow for you for that opportunity.
Thank you, buddy.
Yeah.
No problem.
Great stuff. Oh, there you have it. There's our good 7 minutes with Colton Brewer. And there you have episode 262 of Red Sox Beat. We'll be back again early next week with a little bit more insight and a little bit more clarity, we hope, on how all this is going to look. But again, the big story, we know that there is opening day scheduled now on a Friday night against the Baltimore Orioles, July the 23rd. Better late than never. Thanks so much for joining. This is Josh Lewin. Bye-bye.